approval. But the drawdown of American forces continued, while the progress of the peace talks in Paris waxed and waned, and South Vietnam reluctantly and without adequate resolve or preparation approached nearer the day when it would stand alone. The American public grew ever more impatient for the war to end. The administration, even after the president was reelected in a landslide, did not possess enough political strength to oppose the people's will. Washington did what it could to ensure peace with honor, but the country's priority was to get out of Vietnam, and get out we would. By the time the end did come, with the signing in Paris of the peace accords, my father had retired from active duty. My father prided himself on being a strategic thinker. He flew to Vietnam about once a month to confer with General Creighton Abrams and assess the war's progress. He held Abrams in very high regard, and I believe Abrams reciprocated his admiration. Understandably, my father's appointment initially occasioned some apprehension in the field. He was, after all, an admiral. Vietnam was essentially a ground war, and most of its commanders were generals. It was, I'm sure, the Military Assistance Command in Vietnam, MACV's, hope that my father would confine his visits to a few routine briefings and not attempt to impose a sailor's views on the infantry's war. But although he ably supported his commanders, he was not content to supervise the war from a distance. The war was his responsibility, and he never ducked his responsibilities. He quickly proved himself an astute commander and an important resource for MACV. He won the respect of Abrams and the other senior officers in Vietnam, who came to welcome his frequent visits as opportunities not just to vent their frustrations with Washington, but to take advantage of the old man's counsel. And my father did not affect a regard for the opinion of his soldiers in a transparent attempt to boost their morale. He genuinely believed that their views about how the war was going were just as important as the views of their commanders in Saigon. A participant in one of my father's field briefings described the experience in a letter to me. In the summer of 1968, my father and General Abrams unexpectedly arrived at a battalion base camp in the Mekong Delta. My correspondent, Randy Carpenter, was then a 22-year-old draftee who had, through attrition, been made a platoon leader. He had been asked to present my father with a captured AK-47 rifle. He recounted what happened after the brief ceremony concluded. "Your father, smoking a very large cigar, in a rough voice, politely thanked everyone and asked if he and General Abrams could talk to me in private. Your father asked all of the questions. He wanted to know how much and what kind of action my platoon had seen. He asked general questions about the morale of my men and my morale. The meeting lasted about 15 minutes, and at the end, I was ordered not to discuss any of what we talked about with anyone. He was the commander my grandfather surely had hoped he would become, forceful, determined, clear-thinking, and respectful of his men." Late in the war, my father would give the order that sent B-52s to rain destruction upon the city where I was held a prisoner. That was his duty, and he did not shrink from it. While I was in prison, he never spoke about me at length to anyone other than my wife and mother. When friends offered their sympathy, he would thank them politely and change the subject. Few close observers of my father ever detected that my captivity caused him great suffering. However, his closest aides knew he kept a personal file containing all reported information about the POWs, the location and conditions of the camps, and every scrap of intelligence about me that could be obtained. Carol wrote me every month. The Vietnamese withheld all but a few of her letters from me. She also sent me many packages, few of which I received, and it was always clear that the guards had taken most of the contents before passing a package on to me. My father never wrote me a letter during the war. He knew that the Vietnamese would have regarded a missive from him as a propaganda bonanza. He did try once to secretly pass a message to me. Prisoners were required to write letters home on a pre-printed 6-line form. We were instructed to write only on the lines provided, to write legibly, and to restrict our message to comments about our health and family. Many POWs, however, managed to exceed our captors' instructions and pass encoded messages in their letters home. I too tried to pass hidden messages in my letters. Vietnamese writing makes frequent use of accent marks. I borrowed the fashion from my letters to Carol, placing marks above certain letters to spell out my secret message. My technique was quite obvious, and Carol noticed it immediately. In the first letter in which I attempted covert communication, the marked letters spelled out L-C-O-L-G-U-Y, a reference to Ted Guy, who was then my senior at the plantation. In another, I informed her that I get no mail, I am okay. After reading these letters, Carol, properly, sent them on to Navy intelligence, where my lack of sophistication in encryption aroused considerable concern. An intelligence officer wrote my father's aide to apprise him of my efforts. The officer asked my father's permission to use one of Carol's letters to me to transmit a carefully hidden caution. My father agreed and ordered the message to read, "Junior urges caution. Please stop this." I would have been surprised to receive the message, for I thought I was a fairly clever communicator, or, more honestly, I trusted in the dull wits of the Vietnamese censors to compensate for my indiscretion. As it turned out, my trust was well placed. I never received my father's warning because the Vietnamese withheld Carol's letters from me. So I kept on sending messages in my letters. The Vietnamese never caught me. My father did not meet with any of the prisoners who had been released early, but his file contained all their debriefing reports and reports from officers who had talked with him about me. In a conversation that was reported to my father, a prisoner, one of the August 1968 releases, whom I had been invited to join, informed his debriefing officer that according to camp rumor, I had refused release. He had received a report that a heavily edited propaganda broadcast, purported to have been made by me, had been analyzed, and the voice compared to my taped interview with a French journalist. The two voices were judged to be the same. In the anguished days right after my confession, I had dreaded just such a discovery by my father. After I came home, he never mentioned to me that he had learned about my confession, and although I told him about it, I never discussed it at length. I only recently learned that the tape I dreamed I heard playing over the loudspeaker in my cell had been real. It had been broadcast outside the prison and had come to the attention of my father. If I had known at the time my father had heard about my confession, I would have been distressed beyond imagination and might not have recovered from the experience as quickly as I did. But in the years that have passed since the event, my regard for my father and for myself has matured. I understand better the nature of strong character. My father was a strong enough man not to judge too harshly the character of a son who had reached his limits and found that they were well short of the standards of the idealized heroes who had inspired us as boys. And I'm strong enough now to know that my father had sufficient faith in me to assume I had done the best I could, and that learning I had been broken would only have aroused in him an increased concern for my welfare. On the one occasion when I briefly recounted the experience for him, he listened impassively until I finished, put his hand on my shoulder and said, "You did the best you could, John. That's all that's expected of any of us." My father served two tours as SINCPAC. During his second tour, he suffered a mild stroke. Admiral John Hyland, who commanded the Pacific Fleet at the time, remembered being told by my father's executive assistant that the old man would never be able to come back. He's finished. But my father had other plans. According to Hyland, things just continued to run. We'd all go down to see him every day or so and talk with him and so on. But not very long after that, he came back to duty and he was fine. As the end of his second tour approached, my father lobbied Washington to extend his tenure for another year so that he could continue in command until the war ended. His request was turned down. Despite his apparent recovery, he was never again a well man after his stroke. He lived for nearly 9 years after he retired, but in truth he had, like his father before him, sacrificed his life to hold a command in his country's war. Our treatment reached its nadir after the Atterbury and Dromisi escape attempt. Reprisals were ordered at every camp. Beatings were inflicted for even minor infractions of prison rules. The food was worse. During that spring and summer, I was caught communicating several times. Sometimes I earned a beating for my efforts, but other times I was just made to sit on a stool in the corner for a day or two, like a disobedient schoolboy. The summer of 1969 was a long, difficult time. But as autumn arrived, our treatment began to improve. By the end of the year, the routine beatings had all but stopped. This welcome change in our treatment coincided with the death of Ho Chi Minh, leading many POWs to think that old Uncle Ho must have had a less than avuncular affection for the air pirates occupying his prisons. In August 1969, the Vietnamese released, to an American anti-war delegation, Doug Hegdahl, Wes Rumble, and Robert Frischman. In a change from Johnson administration policy, the Nixon administration allowed the three returned POWs to publicly reveal details of torture and deprivation. The ensuing public fury, led by the newly organized National League of Families of POWs and MIAs in Southeast Asia, of which my brother Joe was an active member, began to turn world opinion against Hanoi. And the Vietnamese, ever mindful of their reliance on international goodwill, decided to suspend their campaign to beat and starve us into submission. We were no longer threatened or tortured to make us confess war crimes or renounce our country. The Vietnamese were now extremely anxious to convince the world that we were well treated. POWs were filmed playing cards and other games, reading their mail, attending religious services, and opening packages from home. Fewer and fewer prisoners were kept in solitary confinement, although I remained alone for several more months. Soft Soap burst into my cell once, highly agitated, and complained, "Even the Russians criticize us. You tell lies about us. You say we pull out your fingernails and make you live in rooms with no ventilation." That Soft Soap Fairy made this complaint while I languished in the suffocating environment of my unventilated cell made the experience only slightly less surreal than listening to the loudspeaker in my cell inform me that the American government was lying about Vietnam's mistreatment of prisoners. My turnkey, the prick, who had started every day by attempting to humiliate me, disappeared from the prison's guard roster. The cat was relieved as commander of all the camps, and thereafter seemed to function as a senior officer of one part of the Hanoi Hilton. From this period on, he seemed almost solicitous of the prisoner's well-being. He often appeared nervous and distressed. Later on, I learned from another POW that the cat had been obliged to denounce himself in front of the party for mistreating prisoners in violation of Vietnam's policy of humane and lenient treatment for all prisoners. On a bitter cold Christmas night in 1969, after I had been transferred from the plantation back to Hoa Lo, the prison where I had spent my first days of captivity, I received an unexpected visitor. The cat entered my room, dressed in a suit and tie, and began to chat with me about home and Christmas. Unlike our previous encounters, he had no need of an interpreter. He spoke English well enough. He offered me cigarettes, which I smoked one after the other. He talked about his experiences in the war. He talked about his family, showing me a diamond tie pin his father had given him. He asked about my family and expressed his regret that I could not be with him this holiday. As he got up to leave, he remarked, "You should have accepted our generous offer. You would be with your family tonight." "You will never understand why I could not," I responded. "I understand more than you think," he shot back as he left my cell. I didn't know what to make of this unusual encounter at first, fearing that it was the precursor to another attempt to release me. After a while, however, it occurred to me that the cat was simply in an expansive holiday mood, and he had wanted to affect the image of a courtly enemy enjoying a brief Christmas truce with a fellow officer. I didn't mind. I enjoyed the cigarettes. By Christmas in 1969, Bob and I were no longer neighbors. On December 9th, another prisoner and I were moved to Hoa Lo, where most of our most senior officers were held. Loaded into the back of a truck, we were blindfolded during the short ride to the Hilton. Unaware of who my traveling companion was, I placed my hand on his leg and tapped, "I am John McCain. Who are you?" He tapped back a reply, "I am Ernie Brace." Ernie and I were taken to a section of the prison the POWs called Little Vegas, where each building was named after a different casino. We were locked in the Golden Nugget. We were given cells near each other with only one other cell between us, and we were able to communicate with each other with little difficulty. Our cells faced the bath area, and by the end of my first day in Vegas, I was able to contact many of the men in the camp. I occupied three different rooms in Little Vegas that year, All of them offered excellent opportunities for communication, and I formed many close friendships with men whom I greatly admired. Treatment continued to improve, although we were periodically subjected to physical abuse for communicating. I remained alone in the Golden Nugget until March, when my period of solitary confinement was finally ended with the arrival of John Finley, whom I was relieved to welcome as my new roommate. That first Christmas in the Golden Nugget, while I was puzzling over my surprise social visit from the cat, my wife was hovering between life and death in the emergency room of a Philadelphia hospital. Carol had taken the kids to her parents' house for the holidays. After dinner on Christmas Eve, she drove to our friends, the Bookbinders, to exchange gifts. It had begun to snow by the time she started back to her parents, and the roads were icy. She skidded off the road and smashed into a telephone pole and was thrown from the car. The police found her sometime later in shock, both legs fractured in several places, her arm and pelvis broken, and bleeding internally. Several days passed before she was out of immediate danger. It would be 6 months and several operations before she was released from the hospital. Over the next 2 years, she would undergo many more operations to repair her injured legs. By the time the doctors were finished, she would be 4 inches shorter than she was before the accident. After a year of intensive physical therapy, she was able to walk with the aid of crutches. Carol has a determined spirit. Had she less courage and resolve, I doubt she would have walked again. With her husband in prison on the other side of the world and 3 small children to raise alone, she now faced a long, painful struggle to recover from her nearly fatal injuries, resisting the prospect of having to live the remainder of her life in a wheelchair. Carol suffered her hardships with courage and grace. She persevered, brave and hopeful, confident that our luck would turn and all our lives would somehow work out all right. When the doctors told her they would attempt to notify me about her accident, she told them not to. She didn't wish to add to my burdens. She would see her way through her misfortune without even the small comfort she might have derived from a few words of concern from me. I've never known a braver soul. My family was often on my mind. I spent a part of each long day wondering and worrying about the psychological burden my long absence imposed on my wife and children. My children were so young when I had left for war. I feared my absence and the uncertainty about my ever coming home would rob them of part of the joy of living that children from happy homes naturally possess. I derived much comfort, however, from knowing that the Navy takes care of its own. Growing up in the Navy, I had known many families that had met with misfortune, and I had seen the Navy envelop them in a supportive embrace. Our neighbors in Orange Park, many of whom but not all were Navy families, were the mainstay of my family's support, and I owe them a debt I can never adequately repay. During Carol's long convalescence and therapy, they were nothing less than an extended family to my family. Today, at odd times, I find myself becoming quite sentimental about America. Now when I think about Americans and how fortunate I am to be included in their number, I see the faces of our neighbors in Orange Park and give thanks that by a lucky accident of birth, I was born an American. In April, John Finley and I were moved to a cell in Thunderbird and were delighted to receive news that the POWs in Little Vegas would be allowed out of their cells for a period each day to play pool and ping pong on tables set up in an empty cell. Our new recreation period, besides being a welcome distraction from prison drudgery, provided an excellent opportunity to improve communications between different parts of the camp. I was designated as the Thunderbird mailman, responsible for carrying notes to and from Stardust, where Jerry Denton was held. Air Force Major Sam Johnson, a great friend and always cheerful resister, was the mailman for Stardust. We hid encoded notes behind a wooden light switch in our new recreation room. In June, I was involuntarily relieved of my duties as mailman. I was caught trying to communicate with Dick Stratton, who was held at the time in a cell in the Riviera next door to the pool room. The next day, I was taken to Calcutta, a filthy punishment room 6 feet by 3 feet with only a tiny louvered window for ventilation. I would be confined there for 3 months. Prior to my arrival, Commander Bill Lawrence, the senior ranking officer of the Golden Nugget and the Thunderbird, another nearby building, had been languishing in Calcutta for weeks. When I was moved to Little Vegas, many of our most senior officers were kept isolated from the rest of us. Bill was my immediate superior. He was a model commander, steady as a rock, always in control of his emotions, never excited, never despairing, or self-consumed. I used to tap him up on the wall for guidance all the time. Calcutta was the first time since I had been released from the hospital that I was unable to communicate with anyone for an extended period of time. My isolation was awful, worse than the beatings I had been sentenced to for communicating. Compounding my misery was the cell's poor ventilation, and I suffered severe heat prostration in the extreme warmth of a Vietnamese summer, one of the effects of which was a constant buzzing in my ears that nearly drove me crazy. I was seldom allowed to bathe or shave. The quality of my food rations worsened. I became ill with dysentery again and started to lose weight. I was finally released from Calcutta in September and moved with John Finley to a cell in the Riviera, two doors down from Air Force Colonel Larry Guarino, with whom we immediately established good communications. In what had now become a routine occurrence, I was again caught communicating and once more confined for a period in an interrogation room. There I encountered the only two prisoners of my acquaintance who had lost their faith completely. They had not only stopped resisting, but apparently crossed a line no other prisoner I knew had even approached. They were collaborators, actively aiding the enemy. The guards would bring them eggs, bananas, and other delicacies to eat. They were on quite friendly terms with the guards, who spoke to them politely. I had a nearly devout belief in the restorative power of communicating. One morning, as I set my bowl outside my cell after finishing breakfast, the guard walked away without locking me back in and was briefly out of sight. I hustled over to the courtyard. "Hey guys, my name's McCain. Who are you?" I hoped that contact with another prisoner might bring them back to their senses. I was wrong. Startled by my greeting, they looked at me for a second, and then, to my intense disappointment, they began shouting, "Bow cow," to summon the guard. I was stunned, and the few blows I received for my audacity from the annoyed turnkey were insignificant compared to the melancholy I felt. The two men remained segregated from the rest of us for the duration of the war. They never attempted, as far as I know, to atone for their disloyalty and regain their self-respect. When we were all released, the two were brought up on charges. The charges were dropped, but they were dismissed from the service. Their superiors, like the rest of the country, wanted to put the war and all its bitter memories behind them. I wasn't disappointed in the decision. The two have to live with the memory of their treachery. I suspect that's punishment enough. Not long after that discouraging experience in early December, I was moved to another cell next door to my dear friend, Bob Craner. Christmas 1970, the most welcome event of my imprisonment. I was transferred with a great many other prisoners to large rooms in an area we called Camp Unity. Camp Unity had seven cell blocks with initially 30 to 40 prisoners held in each. Ultimately, after captured B-52 pilots and crewmen began to arrive, and more prisoners from other camps were brought in, our total number would reach over 350. In the center of each room was a concrete pedestal on which we all slept. A few of the badly injured POWs and our senior-ranking officers were kept in different cells. At Camp Unity, I was reunited with many old friends, including Bob Craner and my first roommate, Bud Day. I was moved there when many of the toughest men in prison were moved into the camp. Jerry Denton, Jim Stockdale, Robbie Reisner, Dick Stratton, George Coker, Jack Fellows, John Dramisi, Bill Lawrence, Jim Kassler, Larry Guarino, Sam Johnson, Howie Dunn, George McKnight, Jerry Coffey, and Howie Rutledge, all legendary resistors, were relocated in Unity's cell blocks. We were overjoyed to be in one another's company, and a festival atmosphere prevailed. If you have never been deprived of liberty in solitude, you cannot know what ineffable joy you experience in the open company of other human beings, free to talk and joke without fear. No other experience in my life could ever replicate my first night in Camp Unity and the feeling of relief that overcame me to be living among my friends. I have lived many happy years since, and am a blessed and contented man. But I will never experience again the supreme happiness I felt my fourth Christmas in Hanoi. In February 1971, we began a dispute with the Vietnamese over their refusal to allow us to conduct religious services in a manner we thought fitting. The church riot began when the camp edict against POWs gathering in groups larger than six and against one man addressing large groups was used to forbid us to hold services. Our senior ranking officer ordered us to challenge the prohibition. On Sunday, February 7th, we held a church service. We had informed our warden, Bug, of our intentions. A four-man choir sang hymns. Soon Bug arrived and yelled at us to stop. He ordered the choir to cease singing. He was ignored, and the service continued. In a rage, Bug had the guards haul Reisner, Coker, and Rutledge out into the courtyard. As they were led out, Bud Day started singing the Star-Spangled Banner, and soon every man in every cell block joined in. When we finished the anthem, we started on a succession of patriotic tunes. The whole prison reverberated with our singing and the wild applause that erupted at the end of every number. It was a glorious moment. Finally, the Vietnamese managed to disrupt our fun when they marched en masse, arrayed in full riot gear, and broke up the party. Reisner, Rutledge, and Coker were taken to a punishment cell in the part of the Hilton we called Heartbreak Hotel. Our senior ranking officer, Vernon Ligon, warned Bug that we would hold church services next Sunday and every Sunday after that. Bud Day, Jim Kessler, and I were among a number of POWs ordered out of the room to be interrogated and harangued by camp authorities for our criminal behavior. A number of senior Vietnamese officers from various camps were standing together in the courtyard, officers who had been responsible for the brutality we had endured in the bad old days. But they were no longer permitted to use torture as a first resort to coerce our submission, and they appeared anxious and uncertain about how to cope with our new assertiveness. When we were returned to our room, Bud, Bill Lawrence, and I discussed our captors' predicament and how at odds they all seemed. We were emboldened by their confusion. The quality of the food declined from bad to awful. Jerry Denton ordered us to begin a hunger strike until our grievances were settled, and Reisner, Rutledge, and Coker were returned to us. At week's end, Soft Soap Ferry announced that it had always been the policy of camp authorities to permit religious expression. Therefore, we would be allowed to hold brief religious services as long as we didn't abuse their tolerance to further our black schemes. As part of Vietnamese efforts to convince the world that we were being well-treated, they had recently stopped using letter-writing privileges as a tool to force our cooperation and begun encouraging us to write home often. I proposed to our senior officers that we begin a letter-writing moratorium until our treatment and conditions were improved. After some discussion, our senior officers agreed, but wisely, made the no-letter policy voluntary. Some men had not communicated with their families for years and were understandably anxious to let their families know they were all right. By summer, however, nearly everyone was refusing to write home. On the evening of March 17th, less than 3 months after we had begun living in large groups, Bud Day, Orson Swindle, a tough, good-natured Marine pilot from Georgia and my close friend, and I were taken from our rooms. Along with 24 others, several men from each room in Camp Unity, we were blindfolded, loaded into trucks, and driven to a punishment camp 10 miles outside Hanoi, a place we called Skid Row. We'd been singled out for our bad attitude, which I somewhat regretted, for it had cost me the open society of Camp Unity. But punishment wasn't the only purpose of our exile from Camp Unity. The Vietnamese had decided to round up all the troublemakers whose influence with the other prisoners made it difficult to maintain order and discipline in the new living arrangements at Hoa Lo. The POWs who remained at Camp Unity called us the Hell's Angels. We were kept in solitary confinement in small cells, 6 by 4 feet, each with a narrow wooden bunk. The cells had no ventilation and were without lights or bathing facilities. The camp had a stinking well with human waste floating in its dank water. My morale sank. Bud Day remained our SRO. He was kept in one of the cells in the back of the building, while I occupied one in the front. Miserable, we took to insulting and arguing with our guards. Bud ordered us to knock it off, believing that beatings were unlikely to improve our wretched circumstances. Bud himself had been beaten and threatened with a fan belt a few weeks after our arrival at Skid Row, and had for a few days been locked on his bunk in stocks. He wanted to spare the rest of us such abuse if it could be avoided without compromising our principles. During our first days in Skid Row, we communicated freely with each other through our barred windows, talking constantly and loudly, our voices bouncing off the wall in front of us. After a week or so, senior prison authorities must have reminded our guards that Skid Row was meant to be a punishment camp for recalcitrant prisoners and instructed them not to show any leniency to us. One morning, as soon as we resumed our conversations of the previous day, the guards appeared shouting, "No talking, no talking." "Bullshit," I yelled back. "I'm going to talk." "No talking, Matt Cain." "Bullshit, I'm going to talk. You bastards kept me in solitary for years. You're not going to shut me up now." One of the guards, intending to terminate any further protest on my part, slammed and locked the wooden shutter over the bars of my door, leaving me fuming in my darkened cell. Refusing to back down, my anger now completely beyond control, I screamed at the guards, "Bow cow, bow cow, open it up, bow cow, open it up, you bastards, open it up." The guards scurried off to find an officer. When they located one, they led him back to my cell and opened up the shutter, finding me red-faced and glaring at them through the bars. "What's wrong with you, Matt Cain?" the officer inquired. "I'm not putting up with this shit anymore. That's what's wrong with me," I answered. "I want to talk, and you're not going to shut me up." The officer left. 10 minutes later, the guards returned and instructed me to roll up my sleeping mat and other belongings. I did as instructed. They escorted me from my cell and chucked me into the cell next door, which was occupied by Navy Lieutenant Pete Schoeffel. This new arrangement suited me fine, and I quickly cooled off. But I doubt Pete welcomed the idea of sharing quarters as much as I did. The cells were hardly suited to cohabitation, measuring little larger than a cardboard box. Two men could barely stand shoulder to shoulder. Nevertheless, Pete took it all in good humor, graciously giving me leave to sleep in his bunk because of my bad leg, while he found what little comfort he could on the concrete floor. In August, monsoon rains threatened to flood the Red River in Skid Row, and we were transferred back to Wallo. For a brief moment, we held out hope that we were being returned to Camp Unity. Our hope was crushed when we marched into Heartbreak Hotel, where we were kept 4 and 5 to a room. The rooms were small and the conditions miserable. Many of the men became ill. A few were suffering from hepatitis. Tempers were frayed, and morale sank even lower. A couple of months later, we were taken back to Skid Row. In November 1971, we were finally reunited with our friends at Camp Unity and put into a cell block together, our morale restored. During the last 14 months at Camp Unity, I served as entertainment officer, appointed to the post by Bud Day. In this capacity, I was ably assisted by a number of my roommates, most notably Orson Swindle and Air Force Captains Jim Seahorn and Warren Lilly. We enjoyed the work. Bud designated me room chaplain, an office I took quite seriously, even though I lacked any formal training for it. Orson and I also served as the communication officers for the room, charged with maintaining regular contact with the other rooms in Unity. We never let a holiday or a birthday pass without arranging a small, crude, but welcome celebration. Gifts fashioned out of odd scraps of material and our few meager possessions were bestowed on every prisoner celebrating a birthday. A skit, always ribald and ridiculous, was performed to commemorate the occasion by embarrassing the celebrant. Marine Corps, Navy, and Air Force anniversaries were also formally observed. Both an avid reader and a movie fan, I took great pride in narrating movies and books from memory. With a captive audience, I would draw out the telling of a novel, embellishing here and there to add length and excitement, for hours before I lost the audience's interest. Our most popular entertainments, however, were our productions of Sunday, Wednesday, and Saturday nights at the movies. I told over 100 movies in prison, and some of them many times over. I tried to recall every movie I had ever seen, from Stalag 17 to One-Eyed Jacks, a camp favorite. My performance was usually well received, although on occasion some of the men's interest flagged when watching a repeat performance for the 4th or 5th time. During the Christmas season, we performed a different skit and sang carols in our crudely decorated room every night for the 5 nights before Christmas. A longer production was saved for Christmas night. Orson Swindell and I, with a few other guys, staged a mangled production of Dickens' A Christmas Carol. A week before, Bud had asked Bug for an English-language Bible. One prisoner was to be designated to copy passages from it for a few minutes. As room chaplain, I was given the assignment. I collected the Bible from where it had been left by a guard on a table in the courtyard just outside our cell door. Hastily, I leafed through its tattered pages until I found an account of the Nativity. I quickly copied the passage and finished just moments before a guard arrived to retrieve the Bible. On Christmas night, we held our simple, moving service. We began with the Lord's Prayer, after which a choir sang carols, directed by the former conductor of the Air Force Academy Choir, Captain Quincy Collins. We all joined in the singing, nervous and furtive at first, fearing the guards would disrupt the service if we sang too loudly. With each hymn, however, we grew bolder, and our voices rose with emotion. Between each hymn, I read a portion of the story of Christ's birth from the pages I had copied. The night air was cold, and we shivered from its effect and from the fever that still plagued some of us. The sickest among us, unable to stand, sat on the raised concrete sleeping platform in the middle of the room, blankets around their shaking shoulders. Many others, stooped by years of torture or crippled from injuries sustained during their shootdown, stood, some on makeshift crutches, as the service proceeded. The light bulbs hanging from the ceiling illuminated our gaunt, unshaven, dirty, and generally wretched congregation. But for a moment, we all had the absolutely exquisite feeling that our burdens had been lifted. Some of us had attended Christmas services in prison before, but they'd been Vietnamese productions, spiritless, ludicrous stage shows. This was our service, the only one we had ever been allowed to hold. It was more sacred to me than any service I had attended in the past, or any service I have attended since. The last hymn sung was Silent Night. Many of us wept. We held a Christmas dinner after the service. We had arranged our room to resemble a dining in, a much-loved military ritual in which officers, attired in their best uniforms, sit at table according to rank to dine and drink in elaborate formality. Lacking most of the necessary accoutrements, we nevertheless made quite an evening of it. From then on, with brief exceptions, our existence in Hanoi was as tolerable as could be expected when you are deprived of your liberty. The Vietnamese had given us several decks of cards, and we played a lot of bridge and poker. An education officer was designated, and classes were taught in almost every imaginable subject. All the POWs were called on to share their particular field of learning. Our classes in amateur theatrics made time, the one thing we had in abundance, pass relatively pleasantly. Our situation improved even more in April 1972 when President Nixon resumed the bombing of North Vietnam, and on my father's orders, the first bombs since March 1968 began falling on Hanoi. The misery we had endured prior to 1972 was made all the worse by our fear that the United States was unprepared to do what was necessary to bring the war to a reasonably swift conclusion. Every POW knew that the harder the war was fought, the sooner we would go home. As the bombing campaign intensified, our morale soared with every sortie. It was after one raid and our raucous celebration of its effect that the guards dragged Mike Christian from our room. Mike was a Navy bombardier navigator who had been shot down in 1967. What packages we were allowed to receive from our families often contained handkerchiefs, scarves, and other clothing items. For some time, Mike had been taking little scraps of red and white cloth, and with a needle he had fashioned from a piece of bamboo, he laboriously sewed an American flag onto the inside of his blue prisoner's shirt. Every afternoon before we ate our soup, we would hang Mike's flag on the wall of our cell and together recite the Pledge of Allegiance. No other event of the day had as much meaning to us. The guards discovered Mike's flag one afternoon during a routine inspection and confiscated it. They returned that evening and took Mike outside. For our benefit, as much as Mike's, they beat him severely, just outside our cell, puncturing his eardrum and breaking several of his ribs. When they had finished, they dragged him bleeding and nearly senseless back into our cell, and we helped him crawl to his place on the sleeping platform. After things quieted down, we all lay down to go to sleep. Before drifting off, I happened to look toward a corner of the room where one of the four naked light bulbs that were always illuminated in our cell cast a dim light on Mike Christian. He had crawled there quietly when he thought the rest of us were sleeping. With his eyes nearly swollen shut from the beating, he had quietly picked up his needle and thread and begun sewing a new flag. I witnessed many acts of heroism in prison, but none braver than that. As I watched him, I felt a surge of pride at serving with him, and an equal measure of humility for lacking that extra ration of courage that distinguished Mike Christian from other men. The bombing of North Vietnam was halted in October when peace talks resumed in Paris. By December, it was clear that the talks had stalled because of North Vietnamese intransigence. On December 18th, at around 9 o'clock in the evening, it was renewed with a vengeance as Operation Linebacker 2 commenced and the unmistakable destructive power of B-52s rained down on Hanoi. Despite our proximity to the targets, we were jubilant. We hollered in near euphoria as the ground beneath us shook with the force of the blasts, exulting in our guards' fear as they scurried for shelter. We clapped each other on the back and joked about packing our bags for home. We shouted thank you at the night sky. No prisoner betrayed the slightest concern that we were in any danger. We just cheered the assault on and watched the show. Once in a while, a guard came by and yelled at us to shut up, to which we responded by cheering even louder. When a Vietnamese SAM hit a B-52, as regrettably happened on several occasions, the explosion and burning fuel would illuminate the whole sky from horizon to horizon, a bright pink and orange glow. In this unnatural light, we could see the Vietnamese gasping at the strange sight and tearing around the camp in a panic. Terrified, some of them fired their rifles into the sky at targets that were miles above them. For many of our guards, this was their first taste of modern warfare, and their confidence in the superiority of their defenses was visibly shaken. Before the B-52 raids, the Vietnamese had always stepped up their pressure on us whenever the United States escalated the air campaign. They knocked us around a little more often. In the aftermath of the B-52 raids, some of the guards who had treated us the most contemptuously became almost civil when speaking to us. It was impossible for us not to feel pride and relief as we watched people who had badly mistreated us recognize at long last how powerful an enemy we represented. The day after the first bombing raid, one of the officers burst into our room and screamed hysterically, "We are not afraid. We are not afraid." After the last raid, an officer entered our cell, smiling broadly as he informed us that they had destroyed all the B-52s. Bud Day looked at the officer for a moment, then laughed and said, "Bullshit." In the bad old days, Bud would have been dragged out of there and tied in ropes for such defiance. Now all the officer was disposed to do was argue with Bud. During one raid that did not involve B-52s, a bomb fell so close to us that shrapnel sprayed the camp courtyard. We took what shelter we could, of course, just in case, but we greeted the low, distant grumble of every approaching sortie like a long-lost friend. We knew that the peace talks were entering their last phase. We all believed for the first time that this would be our last Christmas in prison, and we were drunk with the thought of going home. The B-52s terrorized Hanoi for 11 nights. Wave after wave they came. The Paris peace talks resumed on January 8, 1973, and were swiftly concluded. The accords were signed on the 27th, but we were not informed of the event until the next day, when we were ordered to form in the courtyard for an important announcement. As a Vietnamese officer read the full text of the peace agreement, including the part that provided for the release of prisoners of war, we stood silently at attention. Our senior officers, knowing that this moment was imminent, had warned us not to demonstrate our emotions when the agreement was announced. They suspected that the Vietnamese intended to record the event for its propaganda value and broadcast pictures of jubilant POWs celebrating peace to a worldwide audience. They were right. Film crews were on hand for the ceremony, with their cameras rolling. Not a single POW betrayed the slightest emotion. When the ceremony concluded, we broke ranks and walked quietly back to our cells, seemingly indifferent to the news we had just received. Back in our cells, we waited for the disappointed film crew and the other assembled Vietnamese to disperse, before we began to embrace one another and express our unrestrained joy. Henry Kissinger arrived in Hanoi to sign the final agreement. Near the end of his visit, the Vietnamese offered to release me to him. He refused the offer. When I met Dr. Kissinger back in the States some weeks later, and he informed me of the Vietnamese offer and his response, I thanked him for saving my honor. The prisoners were released in four increments in the order in which we had been captured. On March 15th, the rabbit called my name off the roster of POWs to be released that day. The night before, we were given a large dinner complete with wine, our first substantial meal in a long time. Dressed in cheap civilian clothes, we boarded buses for Gia Lam Airport on the outskirts of Hanoi. As I stepped off the bus at the edge of the airport tarmac, I saw a big, green, beautiful American C-141 transport plane waiting to take us to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines. I nearly cried at the sight of it. At the airport, lined up in formation according to our shoot-down date, we maintained our military bearing as a noisy crowd of Vietnamese gawked at us. I could hear cameras whirring and shutters clicking. Vietnamese and American officers were seated at a table, each holding a list of prisoners. When it was time for a prisoner to step forward, representatives of both militaries called off his name. An officer from his service then escorted each prisoner across the tarmac and up the ramp into the plane. When my name was called, I stepped forward. The American officers seated at the table outranked me, so I saluted them. Just prior to my departure, the Vietnamese had supplied me with another pair of crutches, even though I had been getting along fine without any. I decided to leave them behind. I wanted to take my leave of Vietnam without any assistance from my hosts. 3 days before my release, the Los Angeles Times had run a huge banner headline proclaiming, "Hanoi to release Admiral's son." My father had been invited to join his successor as SINCPAC, Admiral Noel Geiler, at the welcoming ceremony at Clark. He asked if the parents of other POWs had been invited. Told they had not, my father declined the offer. We cheered loudly when the pilot announced that we were feet wet, which meant that we were now flying over the Tonkin Gulf and in international airspace. A holiday atmosphere prevailed for the rest of the flight. Although I am sure I celebrated my liberation with as much exuberance as the next man, I recall feeling that the short flight to Clark lacked the magnitude of drama I had expected it to have. I had envisioned the moment for many years. The event itself seemed somewhat anticlimactic. I felt a little different when we left Clark for home and I bade farewell to men with whom I had formed such strong bonds of affection and respect. We sent one another off with best wishes and promises to reunite soon. But the sudden separation hurt a little, and on the flight home a strange sense of loneliness nagged me even as my excitement to see my family became more intense as every passing hour brought me closer to them. Bud Day and Bob Craner were on my flight to Clark. They and Orson Swindle had become the closest friends I had ever had. We were brothers now, as surely as if we had been born to the same parents. Even after we resumed our crowded, busy lives as free men, we remained close. I still see Bud and Orson often, and I'm most at ease in their company. Bob Craner died of a heart attack in 1981, too young and too good to have left this earth so long before the rest of us. I have never stopped missing him. I flew to freedom in the company of many men who had suffered valiantly for their country's cause. They are the part of my time in Vietnam I won't forget. Prior to the pilot's announcement that we had left Vietnamese airspace, most of us were restrained, having not quite shaken off the solemn formality with which our departure ceremony was conducted. Of course, we expected it would take much longer to shake off entirely the effects of our experiences in prison. I faced a difficult period of rehabilitation, and I was for a long time uncertain that I would ever recover enough to regain flight status. Although I never regained full mobility in my arms and leg, I did recover thanks to my patient family and a remarkably determined physical therapist, and I eventually flew again. Neither did we expect to soon forget the long years of anguish we had suffered under our captor's humane and lenient treatment. A few men never recovered. They were the last tragic casualties in a long, bitter war. But most of us healed from our wounds, the physical and spiritual ones, and have lived happy and productive lives since. We were all astonished at the reception we received first at Clark, and later when we stopped at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii en route to our homes. Thousands of people turned out, many of them wearing bracelets that bore our names, to cheer us as we disembarked the plane. During our captivity, the Vietnamese had inundated us with information about how unpopular the war and the men who fought it had become with the American public. We were stunned and relieved to discover that most Americans were as happy to see us as we were to see them. A lot of us were overcome by our reception, and the affection we were shown helped us to begin putting the war behind us. I once heard the Vietnam War described as America's fall from grace. Disagreements about the purpose and conduct of the war, as well as its distinction of being the first lost war in American history, left some Americans bereft of confidence in American exceptionalism, the belief that our country is unique and exalted and a blessing to all humanity. Not all Americans lost this faith. Not all Americans who once believed it to be lost believe it still. But many did, and many still do. Surely for a time, our loss in Vietnam afflicted America with a kind of identity crisis. For a while we made our way in the world less sure of ourselves than we had been before Vietnam. That was a pity, and I am relieved today that America's period of self-doubt has ended. America has a long, accomplished, and honorable history. We should never have let this one mistake, terrible though it was, color our perceptions forever of our country's purpose. We were a good country before Vietnam, and we are a good country after Vietnam. In all of history, you cannot find a better one. I have often maintained that I left Vietnam behind me when I arrived at Clark. That's an exaggeration. But I did not want my experiences in Vietnam to be the leitmotif of the rest of my life. I am a public figure now, and my public profile is inextricably linked to my POW experiences. Whenever I am introduced at an appearance, the speaker always refers to my war record first. Obviously, such recognition has benefited my political career, and I'm grateful for that. Many men who came home from Vietnam, physically and spiritually damaged, to what appeared to be a country that did not understand or appreciate their sacrifice, carried the war as a great weight upon their subsequent search for happiness. But I have tried hard to make what use I can of Vietnam and not let the memories of war encumber the rest of my life's progress. In the many years since I came home, I have managed to prevent the bad memories of war from intruding on my present happiness. Vietnam changed me in significant ways for the better. It is a surpassing irony that war, for all its horror, provides the combatant with every conceivable human experience. Experiences that usually take a lifetime to know are all felt and felt intensely in one brief passage of life. Anyone who loses a loved one knows what great sorrow feels like, and anyone who gives life to a child knows what great joy feels like. The veteran knows what great loss and great joy feel like when they occur in the same moment. The same experience. Such an experience is transforming. Surviving my imprisonment strengthened my self-confidence, and my refusal of early release taught me to trust my own judgment. I am grateful to Vietnam for those discoveries, as they have made a great difference in my life. I gained a seriousness of purpose that observers of my early life had found difficult to detect. I know my life is blessed and always has been. Vietnam did not answer all of life's questions, but I believe it answered many of the most important ones. I had learned to acknowledge my failings and to recognize opportunities for redemption. I had failed when I signed my confession, and that failure disturbed my peace of mind. I felt it blemished my record permanently, and even today I find it hard to suppress feelings of remorse. In truth, I don't even bother to try to suppress them anymore. My remorse shows me the limits of my zealously guarded autonomy. My country had failed in Vietnam as well, but I took no comfort from its company. There's much to regret about America's failure in Vietnam. The reasons are etched in black marble on the Washington Mall. But we had believed the cause that America had asked us to serve in Vietnam was a worthy one, and millions who defended it had done so honorably. Both my confession and my resistance helped me achieve a balance in my life, a balance between my own individualism and more important things. Like my father and grandfather and the Naval Academy, the men I had been honored to serve with called me to the cause, and I had tried to keep faith with them. Nothing in life is more liberating than to fight for a cause larger than yourself, something that encompasses you but is not defined by your existence alone. When I look back on my misspent youth, I feel a longing for what is past and cannot be restored. But though the happy pursuits and casual beauty of youth prove ephemeral, something better can endure and endure until our last moment on earth. And that is the honor we earn and the love we give, if at a moment in our youth we sacrifice with others for something greater than our self-interest. We cannot always choose the moments. Often they arrive unbidden. During their reunion aboard the Proteus in Tokyo Bay, my father and grandfather had their last conversation. Near the end of his life, my father recalled their final moment together. My father said to me, "Son, there is no greater thing than to die for the principles, for the country and the principles that you believe in." And that was one part of the conversation that came through, and I have remembered down through the years. On that fine March day, I thought about what I had done and failed to do in Vietnam, and about what my country had done and failed to do. I had seen human virtue affirmed in the conduct of men who were ennobled by their suffering. And down through the years, I had remembered a dying man's legacy to his son, and when I needed it most, I found my freedom abiding in it. I held on to the memory, left the bad behind, and moved on.
This has been a Random House Audio Books presentation. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.